Sure.
And I thought about the relationship with his father. It's a very fractured relationship, and it taught me about, remind me about the fractured relationship that Jacob had with his sons when they came and told him the story about Joseph there. It was another elaborate story.
Very interesting. I mean, there are a lot of different ways to look at that. I mean, what they tell their father about Joseph is a lie told to protect themselves for having done something wrong. Whereas what Jonathan tells his father is a lie told to protect David. Well, Jonathan is doing his best, and you're going to see it really today, to satisfy both sides. He is going way above and beyond and really harming himself in doing so. But we'll see that. Let's jump into it. But thank you for the parallel. It's an interesting point. In general, I like to point out in Shoftim and in the beginning of Shmuel, all the things that parents do to their children in Tanakh. But it's also true that there's a lot about what children do to their parents. Wow. I don't know, but I'm really going to jump in because it's 1:32. I apologize for having to rush ahead, but we only have today. Okay. So we started on what I've been calling Yehonatan's tragedy last week, starting with day one when Shaul doesn't say anything about David's absence. And as I explained then, Shaul is aware that Yehonatan is attached to David, and he figures, let me not say anything unnecessarily. If it turns out that David is really around and is not running away, then I only harm my case and rile up Yehonatan by saying anything now, so let me hold off. And then day two, day three, apparently, depending again on how the chronology works, which we've talked about, David is absent. And at this point, Shaul says, where is this Ben Yishai, the son of Yishai, which we said is either a statement of disrespect, like Abarbanel notes, dropping David's own name is a sign of rage and disrespect, or alternatively, as I suggested, that he's saying, this is the son of Yishai. You're my son. He's the son of Yishai. Your loyalty should be to me, not to him. And Leona added the note that there's this irony because Shaul has treated David as a son and talked about it as a father-son relationship. So that adds irony to this as well. So we now see the continuation of Shaul's rage. Yehonatan said in Pasuk Chavtet in sentence 29, David asked my permission to go dine with his family. He is playing peacemaker. Yes, he is lying, Claudette. But he's playing peacemaker. He wants to bring Shaul and David together. He wants to try to keep both relationships. Well, sentence 30. It doesn't work. Vayichar av Shaul b'Yehonatan. Shaul was outraged at Yehonatan. And now, this is not outraged at David, this is outraged at Yehonatan. Vayomer lo, and he said to him, words that are very, very hard to translate. Ben na'avas hamardus, or ben na'avat hamardut, in order to satisfy both sides of the audience here. Either way, what in the world does that mean? What do the words ben na'avat hamardut mean? So the word na'ava, according to most commentators, Radak and many others, comes from the word in Hebrew ayin vav hey. Iva, you could read it as. And what it means is something that is corrupt or crooked. That's one way to take it. That's the majority approach. Rashi has another approach, which is to take it from the word na, nun, ayin, which is somebody who moves around, who wanders, and perhaps who strays. Either way, it's meant to convey Shaul's extreme displeasure. This person is a rebel. And I think I started to explain at the end last time that the way that we read it hinges on how we understand the word ben here. The word Ben can mean son of. However, the word Ben can also mean a person of. Not a son of, the child of somebody, but rather a person who engages in a particular activity. So most commentators here take Ben in the first way, son of, and say this is a comment about Yehonatan's mother. Ben Na'avad HaMardut. So Rashi says, I think I brought it, yeah, I brought it on the sheet. I gave you a list here. So Rashi says that it's making a statement, your mother was not modest, and you're like that too. Your mother strayed, and you stray also. We've never met Yehonatan. We know zero about Yehonatan's mother. But apparently, there's something going on with Shaul. If this is the way he's talking to her son about her. But that's one. Then you also get another comment, which I'm just trying to look at the order I used when I did this on the sheet. Oh, I see. Sorry. This is still within Rashi. Now I understand what I did. Rashi adds to this, and the Malbim actually brought this story at the end of Shoftim, in the story of Pilegish Begiva. If you remember the story there, after the civil war between Binyamin and everybody else, the tribe of Binyamin only has a few hundred males left, 600 I think, and no females left. And the tribes have all sworn that nobody shall marry off their daughters to Binyamin, which means they're going to die out. This tribe is done. So you come out with a solution, and there are two different stages to the solution. The first solution involves the town of Yavesh Gilad. We're not going into that right now. The second stage of it, for the remaining 200, is that there is a festival held in Shiloh. The women are going out to dance there at their festival in Shiloh. And the remaining 200 men of Binyamin should go kidnap wives. And that way, the men, the families did not give their daughters to Binyamin. Binyamin took them. Yes, this story is every bit as bizarre as it sounds. The point of Pilegish Begiva as a story is to show just how far the Jews have deteriorated. This is not, like, salvageable. There's something, you know, grotesque in the whole thing. So, but that's the story. So what the Medrash there notes, and we talked about this when we introduced Shaul, is that Shaul may have actually been one of these remaining men of Binyamin. First of all, we know that Shaul is from Binyamin. That's first off. Number two, we know Shaul is from Giv'ah, which is, you know, where this whole thing started and where this whole thing came from. Number three, if you take the view that the story of Pilegish Begiv'ah took place at the end of Sefer Shoftim, where it's written, and not early in the period, and we had a lot of discussion when we learned Shoftim about that, then the result of that is that Shaul could well have been one of those men who was in need of finding a wife. So with putting all these pieces together, the Medrash says, Shaul is saying, your mother was a bit of a rebel in the sense that I was one of the men. I didn't want to kidnap anybody to be my wife. And so she kidnapped me. She was very forward, and she grabbed me instead of me grabbing her. That's the way that the Medrash plays it. And that way, you have some understanding of how his wife could have been this Na'avat HaMardut, this person who strays, so to speak. Everyone's getting messages from Ricky in the chat, but that'll be for later.
Later.
Thank you. But that's the idea that Rashi brings here in order to explain what in the world Shaul is talking about with this statement about Yehonatan's mother. Yes, Eti.
In English, they translated it, you perverse and rebellious son.
Yeah, we're not there yet. Hang in there. But it's true, but hang in there. An alternative view, Radak's view, is Your mother rebelled against my will, and so do you. But he does not explain where Shaul's mother ever rebelled against the will of Shaul. Then you have Ralbag, who says, you know, the word Mardut can have two different meanings. Mardut can mean a term for rebelling against authority. However, Mardut can also mean someone who doesn't accept ethics. They don't act ethically. So the so Ralbag says it could mean your mother refused to rebuke you. That's why you have become this kid you've become. Your mother raised you poorly, right? It's the way of the father to blame his wife for how the kids turned out. Or alternatively, your mother was not suited for rulership. Look at you. You're rejecting the monarchy. The problem with all of this, minus Rashi's Medrash, is that we know nothing about Yehonatan's mother. The whole thing is so out of left field, it's very hard to understand. So I point you, I see your hand, Ricky. I point you to the idea of the Malbim, who says, and Etty, this may be what feeds yours as well. The Malbim says, you are a foolish rebel for rebelling against your father. Ben does not mean son of. It means you are a rebellious person. You could say Ben is son in the sense he's my son, but then it really should be Beni. The point is, he's saying you are a rebellious person. And then, just because no discussion is complete without Abarbanel disagreeing with everybody else, Abarbanel says, no, that's not what this is at all. He says, this is talking about David. When Shaul says, Ben Na'avad HaMardut, he's talking about David, saying that David is a rebel. Left field approach altogether. Okay, I see a whole bunch of hands. Ricky, Susan, Janine, Claudette is the order in which I saw everybody. Ricky. You're muted.
Why is he, instead of talking about him, what he later said, it could be talking about him. But it's a nasty sort of thing to say.
Oh, we aren't done yet. It's going to get worse. He's not done with Yonatan's mother. Hang in there. And it's going to be very clear he's talking about his mother in the next sentence.
Yes, it's very cheap and it's very...
Understood. This isn't a good look for Shaul. But remember, Shaul is also trying to kill David. Like, you know, on the scale of bad things in Shaul's existence right now, as unseemly as this is, it's not our biggest problem. Okay, Susan.
I have a really puzzling thing here. Now, I've looked, because of the vineyard, and that is the wine press, the Talmudic passage, purge the wine press, which was used for forbidden wine.
No. What they're trying to do there is just to show you that the word na'ava has this meaning as it's used elsewhere. They're not trying to tell you that the wine has anything to do with our story. They're just trying to show you the use of the word. That's all it is. Yeah, Janine and then Claudette.
I didn't raise my hand.
Oh, okay. Claudette. And then Ruth. Ruth and then Ruth.
Is projecting here that it's all his way of growing up. He doesn't want to put the blame where it's supposed to be. As a father, he may not have, you know, being the best to Jonathan.
I haven't seen anyone suggest it, and we don't really have anything in the story as presented in Shmuel to suggest it. Meaning, all we know about Shaul and Yehonatan has been that Yehonatan has been his right-hand man since he showed up on the scene. And that Yonatan's been able to be independent, and as long as he doesn't eat during a fast, he gets away with it. By the way, I'll just use that as a plug, it just reminded me. I sent out the email with the information about Sunday's program on Beyond Hunger, different aspects of fasting in Judaism. It's gonna be a good program, I hope people will be able to participate. And in particular, my 2 o'clock Shear in that is going to draw on the discussion that we had about Shaul's fast and Yehonatan breaking the fast, So since it's been now over a year since we learned that story, if people want to review, that'll be the shiur from 2 to 2:30. I'm also giving a shiur earlier about fasting for a nightmare, and I'm giving a shiur at 3:30. That'll be the shiur on Zechariah. And the question the Jews asked of Zechariah of whether they still need to fast as they're building the second Beis HaMikdash. Yes, Ricky. I'm sorry? Okay. Ruth. Other Ruth.
This criticism of Yom Tov's mother, Shaul has this ruach ra'ah. Maybe it's like a paranoia, and he's beginning to, hate everybody.
That's an interesting idea. It's an interesting idea. I would be looking for a payoff for it, though. Like, at some point, he would actually have to, turn on Yonatan's mother. We never find that. But it's an interesting idea.
But he's criticizing her, and
right.
He's also angry at Yonatan
right.
as well, which it used to be.
I hear you. I think a lot of it is really just a criticism of Yonatan. I really see it as a criticism of Yehonatan and saying, you're bad from the beginning, which means tracing it back to his mother's influence. Because take a look at the next sentences and you'll see what I mean. At Pasuk Lamed, sentence 30, actually not, sorry, still in sentence 30. This was sentence 30, we just didn't finish it. He says, Halo yadati ki vocher ata leven Yishai. Don't I know that you've chosen the son of Yishai? Levoshtecha ulevoshes ervas imecha. For your shame and the shame of the erva of your mother. Well, those are fighting words. Erva, that which is normally kept covered, is identified as erva, that which has been inappropriately exposed. So what in the world is he saying here? So look at Radak. Which I brought you here on the sheet, I think. Yes, there it is. I brought a Barbanel there also. Why did I do it in that order? Oh, I see why I did it in that order. Because what he said, why? Pause before you read Radak. Take a look at sentence 31 first, and then we'll see it both together, and then we'll understand it better. Ki chol hayamim asher ben Yishai chai al ha'adama. For as long as the son of Yishai, he keeps calling him that, is alive here on earth. Lo sikon ata umalchusecha. You and your throne will not be established. Ve'ata, and now, shlach v'kacho so elai. Go bring him to me. You know where he is. Go bring him. Kiven maves hu. Because he's a dead man. That's what he says to Yehonatan. So there are a few things to unpack here, but take a look now at Abarbanel in source number 2. Because he says something which we're going to see in Radak as well, developed further in Radak, that explains what the mother connection here is really about. V'zeshim shich lomar od ki chol hayamim asher ben Yishai chay al ha'adama lo sikon atal malchusecha. When Shaul continues to say, as long as the son of Yishai lives on earth, your throne will not be established. Zehu habusha v'malacha ul'imecha achar mosi be'emes. He says, that's going to be the true shame and humiliation for you and your mother after I am gone. Meaning, I'm going to be gone. David is going to take over as king. And this is as explicit a statement we've seen from Shaul so far about that. He says, this is all going to be gone. When I'm gone, everything is gone. And you and your mother are going to be on the outs. Because David is going to become the king. So this is, as Barbanel sees it, a political statement that he is making. And then Radak says it's not just a political statement. Take a look at Radak in number 3. Ata yomru ha-shom'im sha'ata ohev adam shani sonei. Everyone's going to know that you love this guy who I hate. Ki eincha b'ni, because you're not my son. Which is not a disowning statement. It's a statement that I am not your biological father. That's what people are going to say. People are going to say, there's no way that if he were Shaul's son, he would be siding with David. The fact that he sides with David demonstrates that he's actually from somebody else. Ooh, you're going to cause people to gossip about your mother. That's what he's saying to him. You are the son of a woman who strayed, and that's what people are going to say when they see that you are choosing David over me. So bring him to me. It is time for him to die. That's what Shaul says to Yonatan. Let's put an end to this whole David story. You follow? Boy, is this harsh. The Rav Yonason Eibeshitz, who I quoted last week on this, has a note here to suggest that when he says ben mavetu, he's a person of death, it means that David has rebelled against the throne, because Shaul realizes that David has been anointed. He's saying ben mavetu because he's been anointed as king. He has no right to be anointed as king. I'm currently king. He's a rebel against the throne. To which Yehonatan's response to his father, look at sentence 32. Vayan Yonasan Shaul Aviv. Yonasan says to his father, Vayomer Elav, he says, Lama Yumas, Melsa, why should he be killed? What has he done wrong? His response is, your fight shouldn't be with David, your fight should be with Shmuel. If you have a fight with anybody, blame Shmuel for anointing. I mean, the answer is, you can't punch above your weight class. I'm not messing with Shmuel. But that's the way he understands what Yonatan says back when he says, he hasn't done anything. When Yonatan says that, does that remind anybody of what David said to Eliav? You remember that? When David wants to go fight Goliath, right? He's talking all about it, and Eliab says to him, you horrible, rebellious younger brother, you abandoned the sheep, you're irresponsible. And David says to him, I'm just talking. I didn't do anything. So that's what this reminds me of. Okay. Well, yes, Ruth. So this is the question we've been asking all along, right? What is Shaul's game plan here? And it seems very clear that he does believe that getting rid of Re'acha Tov Mimecha, your friend who is better than you, means that he is king. That seems fairly clear. He believes that Hashem will take him back. Now, things here go from worse to worser. But the essence of the tragedy is in the words that we just read. When Yehonatan says to his father, he shouldn't be killed. Why should he be killed? What has he done wrong? Yehonatan is still trying to convince Shaul to stop. He's tried over and over again. In the beginning of chapter 19, he got him to take an oath he wasn't going to harm David. Then in the beginning of our chapter, he says, all right, I don't believe that he really would ever try it, but, we'll set up this test. And he's still trying to appease his father and get his father to leave David alone. The Gemara points out that Yehonatan is going way further than should be expected here. We have a mitzvah in the Torah. The mitzvah is tochacha. Tochacha means to educate others. When someone is acting in a way that is inappropriate, to instruct them in proper behavior, to show them this is what you should be doing. Tochacha from the word lehochiach. You try to demonstrate the right way. How far are you supposed to go? Are you supposed to do that when the person you are trying to instruct is yelling at you? So take a look at source number 4, the Gemara in Erchin, which is going to bring our passage into it. Ad heichan tochacha. How far exactly is the obligation of educating, instructing, rebuking others? Rav Amar ad haka'a. Rav said, until the person hits you. If he hits you, then you can stop. Ushmuel Amar ad kalala. Shmuel said, until the person curses. Rabbi Yochanan Amar ad Nizifa. Rabbi Yochanan said, until the person blows his top. Then the Gemara goes on, I skipped it, where it brings Tanoim, sages from the time of the Mishnah, who had the same debate. And then you get Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak, who says, Ushloshtan Mikra Echad Darshu. All three of them got it from the same text. Our text. He gets angry at him and he says, and I didn't even bother translating it in my English, I just put in the same words, Ben Na'avad Hamardut. And it's going to continue to say, Vayotel Shaul es hachanis alav lahakoso. Shaul is going to grab his spear to hit Yehonasan. So Lamanda Amar ad haka'a dichsiv lahakoso. The view that we had as Rav's view here, that says you have to try to educate the other until the point where the person hits you, is, look, Yehonasan did it until Shaul tried to hit him. Ulamandam or Ad Kalala, the one who says that you go until the person curses you, because look what he said about Shaul's mother. Levoshtecha, levoshaser vasimecha, that's a curse. Ulamandam or Ad Nizifa, as far as outrage, well, it said, Vayichar af Shaul, Shaul blew his top. Ulamanda Omar Nizifa. If you're going to tell me, though, that it's just until someone is outraged, but here, Yehonatan went further. Yehonatan, he went till his father tried to hit him. His father rebuked him so harshly, he cursed him. To which the Gemara answers, Yehonasan exceeded that which would be expected for Tochacha. Because of his love for David, what Yehonasan is trying to do with his father is not about teaching his father proper behavior. What he's trying to do with his father is to save David's life. And that is the, and that's what drives him to go so far. And that's what I draw from the Gemara here. Is that Yehonatan is trying so hard, just repeating the truth. David has done nothing wrong. Susan, and then Claudette, and then Janine.
There's two entities missing, Hashem and Shmuel. Why put David through this test? I mean, it must be a test because I can't figure out what else it is. Knowing that he's going to be king, what is the whole purpose of Shaul's behavior, of Yonatan's behavior?
So I would say two things. Well, three things. It's a good question. Number one, Shmuel is retired. Shmuel walked away after being forced to anoint David. And
we had him.
Yeah, we did, because they went and got him out of retirement. But he retired.
Yeah.
You can go bang on his door, and he'll take you in. But Shmuel is not interested in being part of this whole drama. Shmuel has walked away. That's number one. And Hashem let him walk away. Because Shmuel didn't even know what was going on. David had to go update him in chapter 18, tell him what's been happening. Chapter 19, tell him what's been happening. So that's number one. Number two, in terms of Shaul, he has free will. Hashem is allowing this to play out. He's not stopping Shaul from doing what he wants with David. And number three, I think in the decline of Shaul, we're also being taught a major, major lesson. All of Shoftim, we said, led in the direction of you need a strong central monarchy. These Shoftim don't work. However, now we find out that the Melech can also fall apart. Because when the Melech disobeys what God has charged him to do, he went, and first he disobeyed by bringing the Karbanos when he wasn't supposed to bring the Karbanos, and then he disobeyed with Amalek. When he doesn't listen to what God is telling him to do, then you end up with this mess. And that's, I think it's intended as a powerful lesson about monarchy.
So is it to teach us that you went from Shofti, they didn't work, but now you thought a new king would work? Well, it ain't.
There are problems here too, correct. That's what I see. Claudette, and then Janine, and then Linda.
Earlier you said that Jonathan was trying to help his father, and I agree with that because I think Jonathan is aware already that David was anointed, and I think he knows that his father knows that David was anointed, and I think he's trying to save his father from doing wrong.
Yeah, that's part of it.
Against God.
That's definitely part of it. Yeah, he also wants to save David's life. But I think that the fact that the Gemara places it as tochacha, you know, as education, indicates that you have, you know, potentially that piece here as well. But Yehonatan is just so torn in this between Shaul and David. Janine.
Regarding tochacha, first of all, are you allowed to rebuke a father?
The answer is yes, but really, really carefully. Meaning, no, in all seriousness, meaning it has to be done respectfully. It can't be the way you would talk to your friend.
So I just find it interesting that, you know, as you spoke, he was more trying to help his friend than rebuke his father, and that the Gemara should learn a lesson from such an unusual circumstance.
Right. No, it's true. I mean, the normal model for the way one rebukes a parent is not to say, this is wrong, but to say, didn't you teach me to do X?
So to learn a lesson from this.
Yeah, I hear you. Linda, and then we're going to go forward, because there's an awful lot still to talk about here.
No, I just wanted to comment on the word tochacha also.
Yeah.
I mean, when you said the word, like I got all tight inside me, because the word tochacha brings up to me the part in the Torah when Bnei Israel is getting rebuked, and I wouldn't have used that word because I never thought of an English translation for that word. I just wanted to comment on that. I mean, that's a very powerful, strong word.
Right.
Did we call the tochacha, like at what point did that come into being?
Right, and so that term is used there because that's the term the Torah uses for warnings of, hey, this is wrong, you better do differently. Meaning, hocheach tochiach es amisecha is the command to us to give instruction. I don't know where it's first called the tochacha. It's an interesting question. Meaning, early sources call it klalot, curses. I'm not sure where it first gets called the tochacha. It's an interesting question. So, Yehonatan, at this point, well, let's take a look. Sentence 32, because we didn't actually complete it. Sentence 33. Vayatel Shaul es hachanis alav lahakoso. Shaul picks up the spear to strike Yehonasan. Vayeda Yehonasan ki chala hi meim aviv lehamis es David. And Yehonasan understands and accepts his father's going to kill David. There's no persuading him. Notice, by the way, the word. It says here, kala hi me'im aviv, right? Kala, it's complete, it's done. Go back to the beginning of the chapter, sentences 7 to 9. Sentence 7, you see that? This is when David is talking to Yehonasan, and he says, if I'm absent and you give the story, and your father says, Tov, right? Then it's fine. Vimcharo yecherelo. But if he gets angry, da ki chalasa hara'a me'imo. Chalasa hara'a was David's phrase for it. You follow? That was David's phrase. Okay. So, Yehonatan is despondent. If you take a look at the next pasuk. Pasuk Lamed Dalet. Vayakom Yehonasan me'im ha'shulchan b'chari af. He's got his own outrage. His father was b'chari af. He is b'chari af. V'lo achal b'yom ha'chodesh ha'sheni lechem. He doesn't eat on that day, whether that's the day, the second day of the month, or whether it's the second day of Rosh Chodesh, we've already talked about. But he is livid. He is not eating. Kine'etzav el David. Now, that phrase is actually hard to translate. It's not clear how to read those last words. In the interest of time, I'm not going to go through your different translations, but instead point you to source number 5, where Radak says it's two different clauses. Al shnei dvarim lo achal lechem. There were two reasons why he did not eat. One, ki ne'etzav bavur David, because he's upset for David. And his father shamed him verbally and with actions. So he's upset for David, and he's upset for himself. Both of these. Because David is going to have to run away, right? And he's lost his father. He's lost both of them. You follow? So this is Yehonatan hitting bottom. I also had an added thought on this. And this is a left field idea. Take it or leave it. I think I can actually, looking at the screen, I think I can predict who's going to take it and who's going to leave it. But let's see. I feel like this is also Yehonatan coming back under his father's control. Go back to chapter 14, sentence 24, please. Chapter 14, sentence 24. Yud Dalet Chaf Dalet. I gave you the reference in source number 6 on the sheet also. Right? What happens in that sentence?
Curses anybody that eats.
Curses anyone who eats lechem. Right? No one shall eat lechem. Right? He wants them to pursue the battle. Whatever the reason is, we'll discuss again in the shiur on Sunday. And Yehonatan, who doesn't know about the oath, goes on in the ensuing sentences to eat some honey. He is told about the oath, and what's his reaction? Yeah, he says, that's terrible. He says, that was such a bad idea, taking an oath like that, right? However, take a look at sentence 43 there, 1443. What's his reaction in the end?
He's ready to die.
He accepts. Right? That's why the Mefarshim read it. Even though we noted when we read it, you could read it as a question. Shall I die for this? I had a little bit of honey on the end. But the Mefarshim don't read it that way. The commentators across the board read it as accepting the decree. He ate inappropriately, and now he accepts the decree. And now here, Yehonatan is again bowed before his father, and he will not eat lechem. His father's original decree. He ate before, now he will not. I don't know, it's a little bit of left field, but I feel like there's something to be said for it. So I said it. Okay, so let's see sentences 35 to 42. Because here Yehonatan has to now face David. He's going to go back to David on the third morning. We think it's the third morning, not going again into the day 2, day 3, day 4. But he's not going to do what he said he was going to do. He's going to do things differently. Sentence 35. Vayhi baboker. It was in the morning. Vayetze Yonasan hasadeh lemo'ed David. Yonasan goes out to the field, to the place that was designated for meeting David. V'nar katoni mo. And he has a young kid with him. Right? Commentators suggest he specifically chose a young nar who would be clueless and wouldn't realize what was going on. He wants somebody who's unsophisticated. Vayomer lenaro, and he says to the nar, Rutz mitzah nayas hachitzim, run, find the arrows, asher anochi moreh, which I am shooting. Hanar rutz, the nar goes running, v'hu yarah hachitzi laha'aviro, and he shot the arrow to pass him or to pass it. Remember, we talked about Mitzudat David, about how he's shooting an arrow and then another arrow, and then the next arrows go past the previous ones. We talked about why he's shooting arrows, whether he's shooting arrows just as a sign, or whether he's shooting arrows to get an indication from God confirming that he's on the right track with what he's doing. I'm not going back and reopening that whole discussion. But Yehonatan shoots the arrows, and then in sentence 37, Vayavo hanar ad mekom achetzi, the nar gets to the place of the arrow or arrows, asher yarah Yehonatan, which Yehonatan shot, Vayikra Yehonatan acharei hanar, Yehonatan calls after the nar, and again we said, according to Malbim, the word nar is part of his message that he's sending, nar versus elem. So he says, Mehera chusha alta. I'm sorry, did I go into a long sentence? Sorry, yeah, he calls after the nar. Vayomer halo achetzi mimcha v'hala. It's further away. Vayikra Yonasan acharei anar. And he calls after the nar. Mehera chusha alta amod. He says, hurry. Right? He's adding to the script. He says, you better get out of town. Vayelakeit nar Yonasan es hachitzim vayavo el adonav. And Yonasan brings the arrows back to his master. So far, relatively straightforward. So far, relatively straightforward, but now watch what happens. Sentence 39. Vehanar lo yada me'uma. The kid doesn't know anything. Ach, Yonasan v'David yada'u es hadavar. But Yonasan and David, thank you very much. I mean, this isn't rocket science. They understand what's going on. Vayitein Yonasan es kelav el hanar asher lo. Yonasan gives his tools, his equipment, to the nar. Vayomar lo lecha ve'ha'ir. And he says, go bring these to the city. Hanar ba. So the youth goes back. V'David kam me'etzel ha'negev. And David rises from the southern area. Vayupola pav arza vayishtachu shalosh pe'amim. He falls and he bows three times. Right? We've talked about the sets of three. We had the idea of the three, you know, with Yosef, three, you know, the sets that we've seen in this parak so far. Vayishku ish esrei'eyu, they kiss each other. Vayivku ish esrei'eyu, they cry with each other. Ad David higdil. I'm not translating the words ad David higdil yet, because it's not so clear what they mean. And then finally, vayomer Yonasan David lech l'shalom. Yonasan says to David, go to shalom. Asher nishbanu shneinu anachnu b'shem Hashem le'mor Hashem yeh b'ni u'b'necho v'ein zari u'b'ein zaracha ad olam. We swore Hashem will be between us and between our descendants. That covenant that we made in the name of God, that covenant is going to protect us together forever. And then, I'm jumping to the first sentence in chapter 21, because it's clearly part of this story. Vayakam vayelach v'honasan b'ha'ir. David got up and went, and Yonasan went back to the city. So, what's the big problem that we just read? Not a small problem, big problem.
Was David supposed to run away?
Yeah. What in the world was that about? David was supposed to run away once he saw the signal. Why didn't, what is this? So you could just say, easy answer. Sorry, Janine.
I just want to say maybe he realized that they were going to be separated, and therefore he sent away the Nar so he wouldn't see that he's meeting David.
But didn't he know that? But that was. Why didn't you plan it that way in the first place?
Maybe his emotions took over.
So you could say it's emotions. I think that's possible. I thought you were going to say something else, which is that Yonatan never expected this. Yonatan really believed his father was not out to kill David. It didn't dawn on him this was going to happen. In Yonatan's mind, he's, you know, appeasing David, let David, you know, he's scared, fine, I'm gonna go through this thing, and then it's gonna turn out it's fine, he's gonna come back to the palace. It doesn't even dawn on him that he's actually gonna have to say goodbye to David. And so that's why he didn't plan for this moment. And he is, you could say, overtaken by emotion. Rabag is always practical. Rabag says no. If you take a look at source number 7, yeah, in the, it's Ray 2:14, so I'm going to say it outside, but you have the text there. He says the plan was only in case there are other people around. But now Yonasan sees there's nobody around. David sees it and recognizes it as well. And so they're safe to meet with each other. He's got the practical approach. But I think it's really, Yonatan never expected this. So they have this intuitive bond, and Yonasan can predict what David's going to do. So he sends the youth away. Sure enough, David comes out, and Yonatan is able to talk to him, and, you know, breaking the script as well. But interestingly, hang in there, Ricky. Interestingly, when David comes out of the woods, what is he demonstrating?
Trust.
Remember that in the beginning of our chapter.
Love.
Well, trust is really what I would say. The love is demonstrated also here, but the fact is, in the beginning of the chapter, David said, if I've done something wrong, you should just kill me now. And Yonatan took that as an insult. He took that as a statement. You think I want to kill you? Now, David is demonstrating that he trusts Yonatan. He didn't run away. He came out to see him. Ricky, and then Leona. No, you muted yourself.
So if Yonatan, what is the indication that Yonatan was not expecting this? I mean, David is the one, sounds like he ran over.
What do you mean? I don't understand what you're saying. This wasn't the plan. He gave him instructions. He said, I'm going to shoot the arrows, and if I tell the Nar that they're further away, you run away. This wasn't the plan at all.
I'm just wondering why you said that you were talking about Jonathan not expecting this move.
I'm not saying he didn't expect this move. I'm saying that nobody planned this move. Neither of them planned it. And Jehonatan, by sending the youth to the city and staying there, anticipates that David is going to come out to greet him. And that's why he does it. Yeah, Leona.
I'm going out into left field here, but...
I'm glad I'm not the only one.
But Shalosh Pamim reminded me of something else in this whole little incident. It reminds me, I hate to say this if everybody else be a little annoyed with me, it reminds me of the period of the Akedah.
Why the Akedah?
Because Shalosha Yamim, they went for 3 days.
Oh, well, you've got lots of 3-day periods in Tanakh.
Yes, but this one in particular, because Yonatan is like, in a sense, the angel that saves Yitzhak from being killed mm-hmm. by his father.
Interesting.
I know it sounds a little weird, but I think it's a sign of thankfulness as well as trust. I think he always trusted Yonatan, actually. Mm-hmm. I have no reason to think he was suspicious of his motives.
Well, Yonatan thought he was...
expressed his love to Yonatan. Yonatan many times expressed his devotion and love to him. So I think it was a sign of thanking Hashem and thanking Yonatan, which was his final thing, that he acknowledges what Yonatan has done on his behalf.
I hear you. Yonatan was suspicious of his motives. You know, Yonatan thought that David was suspicious of his motives, I should say. So it's not like we invented that. That's Yehonatan thought. But I hear you. I thought you were going to say 3 times was Bilam hitting his donkey 3 times, since that's in the Parsha this week.
No.
Okay. I see more hands. I still have a little time left. Jeanette? Sorry, you had your hand up?
Yes. Sorry. No, in terms of the lack of trust, just very briefly... I don't think we have to look at it as anything negative, that David had his concerns. And it doesn't mean that he didn't know that Yonatan loved him, just in answer to what Leona was saying. But at the same time, I think David was wise. I think David understood Yonatan maybe better than Yonatan understood himself. He understood that Yonatan was very torn. You know, and perhaps it's not until the last minute, as he keeps trying and trying and trying to bring peace to the situation, and he realizes he can't, that he has to make that very difficult decision.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot to be said. You can read multiple layers to the relationship. That's what I would say. Claudette, and then we're going to go further.
My translation says that they went together.
I'm not doing the rest of the sentence. I'm not doing the rest of the sentence yet. We're not there yet. Hold off. Hold off. We'll get to your translation. We're just not there yet. I want to talk about the bowing first. Why do people bow in Tanakh?
Respect. For gratitude.
So I'll tell you. I found 3 different kinds of bowing that I think are relevant here. Someone mentioned gratitude. Absolutely. If you think of Avraham when he wants to get a grave to bury Sarah, so Vayishtachu lam ha'aretz livnei chet, he bows in gratitude. Avraham's servant who goes to get a wife for Yitzchak, right? So he bows to God. When his prayer is answered. So we have bowing as gratitude. Hang in there, Hannah. Just a minute. I want to go through the list first, and then you can add. There's also bowing that is an act of respect, as some mentioned, and submission. So that on the one hand you have the respect, lot, for the malachim that come to Sodom, he bows to them. You also have Yaakov bowing to Esav, which is taken as more than respect, it's taken as submission, and he's even, in the Midrash punished for it. Yosef has a dream of his brothers bowing to him. So that's a second kind. And then a third kind of bowing is bowing that is an appeal for help. Yosef's brothers, when they first come down to Egypt, right? They bow to him not knowing who he is. You could say that's general respect, but it seems like it's part of their request for support, is this bowing. It's an appeal for help. I think all of those are relevant here. David is doing all of the above. He is expressing gratitude. There's an element of respect and submission, and there's an element of appealing for help as well. Chana, you were going to say? Right, it's a thank you. Well, it was a thank you for the good news. No, but it's not about the good news. The bowing there is gratitude for being told this. That's the idea. So it's a gratitude bow there, I think. Okay. Did anyone find other resonances to bowing that might be relevant here? I think I got a pretty good list. Okay.
So when did it become unacceptable for Jews to bow?
So in general, you're not allowed to bow to somebody in a way that is idolatrous. But in and of itself, the act of the bow is not inherently prohibited. There's a lot of discussion because of this in martial arts. When Jews practice martial arts, are you allowed to bow to the other person? Is that some kind of ritual, or is it just a matter of showing respect? But no. I mean, there are certain things which our parents teach us not to do. Like, you're not supposed to kneel on the floor also, right? The halachic piece of it is not always in consonance with what the parents are saying. Yes, Claudette. So there's a lot of discussion about why he refuses to bow to Haman. That's why you have a Gemara that says that Haman is wearing an idol around his neck, because there should be nothing wrong with bowing. All right, Claudette.
Is it because in the cultures around the Jewish community, people bow for a different reason? Because in the African community today, till they like today, you bow before a senior person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you go and you meet somebody that is older than you, you bow, and, right. You know.
So again, there is an issue of bowing as idolatry, which could have been affected by what Jews are seeing around them. I'm just going to stop the discussion part now because I see I have 7 minutes left and we have stuff to see. As it is, we're not going to get to the review questions, which I was really hoping to go through. But you have them, and you'll be able to do them. But they cry until David Higdil. In Pasuk Mem Aleph. The word higdil, until he did more. What exactly does that mean? More than what? So some read higdil as a word that's meant to explain why Yehonatan is sending David away. Higdil indicates there's something here that causes him to send David away. What does that mean? So Malbim, which I brought you in source number 9, says higdil means he cried really loudly. And Yehonatan is scared that someone is going to come along and is going to then see David. So that's one explanation. Ralbag takes it in a different way, also though that it's about something that causes him to send David away. In source number 10, Ralbag says higdil, he cried more than was appropriate for the situation. Meaning, his crying was not just grief, but as Rabbag continues, his crying is fear. Shaul wants to kill me. And so, because of that, Yehonatan says, you better go, because you're panicked. So he's sending him away not because of detection, but because he sees that David is panicked. However, Rashi and Radak say no. David cried more than Yehonatan cried. And finally, we get a clear statement of David's emotion for Yehonatan. We've been waiting for that. Finally, it shows up. So I've been quoting off and on an article from Megadim by Rabbi Yosef Goel Didi. He was the one who I quoted who argued that David was not able to run away until he got permission from Yehonatan, because they have this covenant. So he also was of the belief that while Yehonatan loved David, David did not love Yehonatan until now. Take a look at source number 12. I think he goes a little too far with this. But nonetheless, it's beautiful the way he writes it. I'm just going to give you my translation. David cried more than Jehonatan, even though in the text, as we have seen, Jehonatan was the one who loved David like his own life. Why is David crying more? Now, David understood how much Jehonatan loved him. Jehonatan enabled him to go, despite knowing that this would destroy his own monarchy. Right? In other words, Jehonatan, as Shaul said, has to recognize, you free David, you're deep-sixing your own throne. More than David was pained by separation, he was pained at the reality that he had not trusted the one person who loved him truly like his own life. It's a very strong way to frame it. I'm not so sure he's right, but I think it's a beautiful idea that he's expressing here. I think it's very strong. You could suggest, as Linda does in the chat, that Higdil meant overcame, until David overcame, but then overcame what? It didn't really say. You could say he overcame his emotions, maybe. The commentators don't go that route. And so Jehonatan sends David on his way. I note for you parenthetically, no questions and comments yet. The Gemara in Brachos, at the end of Brachos, that says, I put it on the sheet in source number 13, which says that when you part from somebody else, you're supposed to say, lech lishalom, not lech bishalom. I get people sometimes who send me emails and sign it bishalom. That's no good. You're not supposed to do that. Shalom, shlemut, completeness, suggests you are at rest. You have nothing left to accomplish. So, only the dead are bishalom. The live people should be going lishalom, towards shalom. So the Gemara doesn't make the statement here. It makes the statement about David and Avshalom. And you can see the source that I brought you here in source number 13. But here you see, Jehonatan says to him, lech lishalom, go to peace. Last note. In the previous perek, right, in chapter 19, we saw that Jehonatan wanted to keep both Shaul and David. And so he tried to create peace between them. At the start of our parak, we saw Jehonatan insist to David that this peace was going to hold, even as David insisted that Shaul wants to kill him. We saw David test Shaul and really test Jehonatan. Would Jehonatan be loyal? And we saw Jehonatan try to keep both of them, trying to calm down his father, failing, and apparently, as we said, losing both Shaul, who rebukes him publicly and tries to kill him, and David, because David has to leave. But here we get one thing at the end. Jehonatan recovers some of his losses. First of all, David cries more than he does. So he's gained David's allegiance. Even if David until now was not displaying his loyalty to Jehonatan, now he really is. That's number one. Rav Bazak also notes something else, which is terribly tragic and fascinating. There's a line in the eulogy that David delivers for Shaul and Jehonatan in the beginning of Shmuel Bet, where he says, Hane'ehavim v'hane'imim b'chayehem, they were beloved and pleasant in their lives, uvimotam lo nifradu, and in their death, they weren't separated. And usually we read that as a nice statement about their bond with each other. Says Rav Bazak, oh, is it sharper than that? Source number 14, look at my English translation here. Jehonatan arose and came into the city, the beginning of the next chapter. This verse sharpens the reality that in the end, Jehonatan did not go with David, but returned to the city. Perhaps there was no other option here. And one should not entertain the thought that Jehonatan should have gone with David and separated from his father. That's not realistic to expect. But the bottom line, he says, is that in this verse, Jehonatan seals his lot. Once he ties his lot with the lot of his father, and not with David's, it is necessarily decreed that Jehonatan will die with his father in Hare Gilboa, and not take part in David's future monarchy. I think Rav Bazak is dead on, so to speak. I think he's 100% right. This is the moment where it is sealed that Jehonatan is going to die with Shaul. This moment was, it appears, the most tragic in Yonatan's life. And he says, it is very possible that this is the subject of David's elegy. Shaul and Yonatan, as I just said to you, who are beloved and pleasant in their lives and in their deaths, were not separated. Yonatan's choice to remain beside his father in his lifetime brought about the fact that in their death, the father and son were not separated from each other. Isn't that a remarkable read? I think he's 100% right. Yes, correct. There's a typo that happens. But this is, that piece of it is tragic, but Yehonatan is doing what he can to salvage the relationships. He has a bond with David still, and it's going to come back. This isn't the last time they see each other. We're going to see chapter 23. But this is the attempt to get something from the relationship with David, and then opting to continue the relationship with his father. You follow? It's an incredible, incredible thing. So first of all, it's ready after 2:30. Those who have to go can go. But thank you very much for another year of Shmuel. It was quite the year. We started out in, what was it, Perek Yud Zayin we started the year with Goliath? Yes. So we've gone from Yud Zayin, I think, was the beginning of the year. I'm pretty sure. So we did four prakim. We did four prakim this year, but those were quite the prakim. Alina, thank you for your willingness to host.
This is the saddest of all the prakim.